Good morning, fellas. My name's Don, and I'm an alcoholic.
Good morning, Don. Morning, Don.
And can we start with that little prayer, please? God, please help me set aside everything I know or think I know for an open mind and a new experience with myself, my illness, these steps, and especially you. Amen.
Amen.
I didn't say prayer right that time, but I guess I got the point across, I think. To think we said something about God not needing specific instructions anyway, didn't we? Yeah. I think most of y'all were in here when I said this morning, but let me say it again, because it's just the truth. I was in there praying in a little cabin this morning and running you guys through my head, and decided a pretty special group down here this weekend. And I really did. I got to think about each one of you guys, and each one of you just seems real special to me, and I sure do appreciate having been able to be with you this weekend. I sure hope you guys have gotten something out of it, but whether you have or not, I have really gotten a lot out of it. Just watching and listening to you guys has had a real impact on me. And I'm not just flapping my gums, I mean it, every one of you. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. What we're going to do this morning for a little while is talk about the maintenance steps and living sober. Before we really start talking about that, though, I want to tell you a few things that Cherry Carpenter told me about the steps and about maintenance and about living sober. I don't think I've mentioned this yet, but I would have a tendency, like we all do, I'd be talking to Cherry and I would say something about my program. And he would jump right down my throat and say, "Partner, your program is what got you here. Just like your program, my program is what got me here." And he said, "There isn't your program and my program, there's the program. And it's numbered 1 through 12. And that's real important to me. And I have tried not to refer to my program. And it's just a little thing in a way, but it also affects my mindset. If it's my program, I'm doing it my way with my interpretations, with all this latitude. And I'm right back to where I was all my life trying to fix myself with my brain. And it never has worked. But if it is the program and it is just there, you know, sure, I may see it differently from you or from the next guy, and that's perfectly all right. But the program is there. It's in black and white, and it's numbered 1 through 12. And that has been real, real important to me. In my life, sober, since I finished these first 9 steps, and the book tells us specifically that when we have finished these first 9 steps, sanity will have returned. We'll be in a neutral spot with regard to alcohol. We'll react sanely and normally when we're confronted with something like that. So that's the insanity I was taught that the second step is talking about. The second step doesn't mean that if we do all these steps to stay in here that a higher power is going to come down and make us feel perfectly sane all time in every area of our life. That's never happened to anybody that I know of. What it means is that basic insanity, the insanity that was killing us, the inability to keep from picking up that booze and that dope, that insanity will be gone. That sanity will have returned in that area, and we'll start reacting normally. But throughout my whole sobriety, just before we start talking about maintenance, I'll share with you guys what I do. I've never, for any period of time, dropped below 4 or 5 meetings a week. I've never ceased morning and night to get on my knees. I told y'all earlier that a lot of mornings it doesn't feel right. Doesn't seem like to me it's working. You know, I may be scared to death and can't remember what I prayed. And I've good 80 or 90% of the mornings of my sobriety, I've done my reading, reading some out of the big book, reading the Prayer of St. Francis out of the 12 and 12. That getting on my knees every morning and every night is the second most important thing in my sobriety. I don't tell anybody, I don't have rules of sponsorship, and I don't have any criticism of those sponsors who do. It's just the way I do it. I don't have rules of sponsorship. But I do tell folks that ask me to sponsor them, I say, now you'll have to make your decision, but I want to tell you that if you need somebody to tell you how to stay sober without getting on your knees morning or night, you better get at least an additional sponsor, because I don't have any experience in that area. There may be all sorts of ways for you to stay sober without getting on your knees morning and night, but I don't know any of them, because the only thing that's worked for me is to get on those knees every morning and every night. And it is important that I do my praying for me, that I do my praying on my knees. The way that knee deal developed was that when I first started my praying very early, and talking about the first couple of weeks that I was sober and had begun to act as if, sometimes I'd get up in the morning and I couldn't remember whether I'd prayed or not. And old Gene Crotts that I mentioned earlier, Gene said, well, get on your knees. You'll remember it if you get on your knees. And that's the way the getting on the knees part started, was so I would remember that I'd prayed. When it started, when I got to realizing it was working, I was staying sober, I got so afraid that I would forget to pray, that I would do things like every morning leave myself a note. I knew I was going to run right to the coffee pot. I'd leave myself a note under the coffee pot to pray. And didn't have but one pair of shoes there in that attic in Nashville, so it was real easy to know what shoes I was going to wear the next day. Sometimes I would write myself a note to pray and crumble it up in the toe of those shoes, so that if I forgot it, I'd be putting on those shoes and I'd catch that note in there, and I would remember to pray. But that praying morning and night is the second most important thing in my sobriety. The most important thing in my sobriety, every day of my sobriety, has been, and it is this morning, that today, just for today, with God's help and you guys, I'm not going to drink or take dope if my butt falls off. Because you see, all of this spirituality that we've talked about this weekend, all of this growth, all of this material recovery that always, by the way, we talked about that last night, somebody was, and we were all tired, and I didn't mention this, but you know, the book tells us very specifically that material well-being always follows spiritual progress. It never precedes it. Never, ever. That if we take care of the spiritual, the rest of it will all fall into place. But you see, all of those beautiful things, this beautiful wife I've got, my wonderful relationship with my children, you guys wanting me to come down here and do this with you, you know, what a joy, you know, what a wonderful thing. All the people in my life, the fact that I feel good, my law practice, the fact that I have some respect from folks in my life, in all areas of my life, none of it works. All of it is gone out the window if I pick up the drink or the drug on any day. It's so easy to get in spiritual graduate school, you know, when we get so far from that last drink or that last drug, and forget, yeah, this is what it's about. And again, I have no desire to embroil in any controversy, and some people find it helpful to say that Alcoholics Anonymous isn't about not drinking. And I can understand intellectually how they would say that, and I wouldn't argue with anybody that says that. But I will tell you that for me, guys, Alcoholics Anonymous is all about not drinking, taking dope. And if you don't think that that is necessarily true, check the spiritual condition of the next friend you've got that goes out and picks up. See if you find much in that fellow the day after he's picked up that you want with regard to his spiritual condition. So So the most important thing, and it, you know, it's still the same as it was. I had to learn in the first 2 months I was sober that God wasn't going to knock a drink or a drug out of my hand, that ultimately that was my job. That is still true today. Now, every day for all those years, God has given me not only not doing it, but not wanting to do it. And I still think about drinking and drugging. Thinking about drinking, drugging, wanting to do it's two entirely different things. And I don't know how you ever completely flush out of your memory cells that recollection of what that big blast of booze would do inside your stomach and that warmth and the way it would take away the edge of that pain that you were feeling at that time. I don't know how in the world you would ever completely vanquish that memory. And I have that memory, and that memory comes to me sometimes frequently, sometimes just every once in a while, but it is a memory. You know, it's immediately followed by a sane reaction of realizing, yes, but my God, the price I would pay for that fleeting relief. Mm-hmm. You know, the price that I would pay is like jumping off a 40-story building because the ride seems like a good idea. You know, that's exactly what it's like for me. But at any rate, I did want to make that clear, that all of the spirituality is wonderful and it's necessary that for me that we do these steps, but where it is not drinking or drugging today, just for today, regardless of how bad I might want to drink or drug sometime later on today. And I know from many years' experience that if instead of going on and doing what I want to do, if I'll reach to you guys and my God for help, that the help will readily be there, that I don't have to do that today. Now, another thing. Book tells us as we go into the maintenance steps. We're talking about the maintenance steps, and real simple. Those are steps 10, 11, and 12. Having done 1 through 9, we have done the entire program of recovery, and we are in a state of recovery from alcoholism. But the book tells us that we're not cured. We're not cured anything. That incurable, progressive, and fatal thing is still sitting right there at our feet, ready to devour us if we don't do what we're told we have to do. And what we're told we have to do is that we have to maintain our spiritual condition, so that we'll get our daily reprieve, and that reprieve is contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Now, this has become so important to me. The first 2 or 3 years that I was sober, I was scared to death because I had read that over and over and over again, and just, you know, this messed up perception I've got of not seeing things right, not hearing them right. What I thought that said was that my daily reprieve was contingent on my spiritual condition. And Lord, I'd wake up some morning, still do, and my spiritual condition feels like to me it's a crock of manure. You know, I wake up scared, I wake up with all sorts of things. I don't do that most mornings, but it still happens. Believe me, it happens. So I was scared to death, and I thought every day that I felt like my spiritual condition was not good, that I was at risk for drinking and drugging. But fellas, that's not what that says. My daily reprieve isn't contingent on my spiritual condition. It is contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. Now, I talked about the car, and we were talking about the first step to about the difference between unmanageable and failing to manage well. The same thing, a car can be used on the condition thing. That car sitting up there has a condition. Whatever that condition is at this point, and sitting out here in the middle of this lake, there is nothing I can do about that. If that condition is that there's a wire ready to short out and it's going to blow up in 15 minutes, not much I can do about that. On the other hand, the maintenance of that automobile is a specific series of actions over which I have just about total control. It's a completely different thing from the condition that the automobile is sitting there in. Now, what that means, and it's the greatest news in the world, that means that I can wake up feeling absolutely spiritually bankrupt, like I have no contact with my higher power. I don't want to have any contact with you guys. I'm just disgusted with all of it. I can wake up feeling like it won't do a bit of good in the world, get down on my knees and say those prayers, but I make myself get down there and say those words. And then I can look at those meditation books that I read this morning, that I read every morning, thank God I know all of that crap in there anyway, and I don't want to read that. But I can pick them up and make myself look at those pages and go through it, even though I have my mind so distracted I can't remember the last word that I read. And then I can feel like that I'm so busy with my important problems that I hadn't got time to mess with some damn drunk calling me up to whine about his girlfriend or not having a job or something. And I can be told that one's on the phone to do just exactly that, and I can have every one of those feelings, but I can make myself, with God's help, pick up that phone and say, yeah, Bill, how you doing this morning? Everything okay? Can I help you? And I can sit there and pray, even though I don't want to do it, the 11th step prayer through my head to make me a listener, and I can listen to old Bill, and I can give him the response that I can act like a decent, concerned, loving fellow member of AA, even though I'm feeling like a spiritually bankrupt yap. And if I do that, and then comes time for the noon meeting or 5 o'clock meeting at the Jeff Token Club, I can think, my God in heaven, I know everybody in that meeting. I know everything that they say, and they say it every single time. And besides that, I can't hear very well. Even though I know it, I can't hear 80% of what's going on there, and I'm so busy, I've got all these other things to do. I just don't need to go to the damn thing. It won't do me any good, but I can make myself go anyway and sit there and pray the 11th step prayer, "Thy will be done. I'm no longer running the show. Lord, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand these folks rather than to be loved, comforted, and understood." I can go home. I can get on my knees, even though I don't want to do it still. Usually by this time I do. Even though I don't want to do it still, I can get on my knees and thank God for this day of sobriety. And this book guarantees me that on that day I will not drink. Even though I have felt spiritually bankrupt and I felt like my spiritual condition was crap all day, I have done the actions that constitute maintenance of my spiritual condition. And it is that action that gets me my daily reprieve, not something that I have no control over, which would be what my condition winds up being. And that's such good news, that it's my actions that give me my daily reprieve, not some sort of cosmic lottery where it's pulled out. Oh, Don's spiritual condition's bad this morning, he may get drunk. And it's not that way. If I do what I need to do, I'm not going to drink today. I'm going to have it. Cherry told me that, and this is not a big thing with me, and I'm not, you know, suggesting that anybody else adopt it, but it has been very useful for me, and it didn't make a bit of sense to me when Cherry first started telling me this. I've already mentioned that he taught me that the first 9 steps are the entire recovery program. He taught me also that once you have done the first 9 steps, that you don't ever do those again, that you have done that you have finished that. But he went on to say, and this is why I couldn't see why in the world he was making the point, just didn't make any sense to me at all. He said, now Don, the maintenance steps, 10, 11, and 12, involve everything that's in the first 9. So in the course of living your life on 10, 11, and 12, you are probably going to redo practically everything that you did in 1 through 9, and he said it may very well be part of your 11th step meditation that you'll want to read and say the 3rd step and 7th step prayer every morning of your life as part of your 11th step meditation. Said you may do inventories. Said you may do inventories that you use the form on page 65 just exactly, and somebody looking at it could not see the difference between it and a 4th step inventory. But you already did your 4th step down, you'll be continuing to take personal inventory under step 10. And like I say, it seems like a small thing, but it's wound up for me in my sobriety been a very handy thing because, see, I have done the program for recovery. I'm not stuck in that deal of always being a recovering alcoholic and never getting okay. I'm okay,
mm-hmm.
and I'll stay okay. I've done the program for recovery. I will stay okay as long as every day of my life I live on 10, 11, and 12 to maintain my spiritual condition. And the 10, 11, and 12 have absolutely everything we need to maintain that spiritual condition. Step 10, of course, says that we continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And I mentioned earlier, I think, that a friend of Billy Hogue's and mine, David P. from Buffalo, New York, says that the most important word in the 12 steps is continue. That's the most important. That word continue is used three times in the first paragraph where the book talks about step 10 in the middle of page 84. Says that we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear. Says that we continue to take personal inventory, continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. It's all a matter of continuing. And especially for the newer guys here this morning, one of the most beautiful things about recovery for me in Alcoholics Anonymous has been that everything that I ever had in my life, if it seemed like it worked for a while, if I squeezed it too hard or tried to hold on to it because it was working, it would either squirt out of my hands and be gone or it would crumble in my hands. This is the only thing I've ever found that the harder I squeeze it, the better it gets. What we're hooked into is just simply all the power in the universe, and we can't hug it too hard. The more we hug it, the better it gets. Book tells us about this point in step 10 that we're not shy about prayer. It tells us that we take the vision of God's will into all of our activities. Already said that it tells us sanity will have returned. And it says when we take that vision of God's will into all of our activities, try and do that next right thing, that our right to use our willpower has returned to us. On page 84, it says, we can exercise, or 85, we can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. See, that tells me there was nothing ever wrong with the fact that I'm a strong-willed person. What was wrong was my abuse and misuse of that will. And this is telling me that after I've done that nine-step program for recovery and have begun to live on 10, 11, and 12, I've recovered to the point where I can use my will properly, which is to try to conform my actions to my God's will a step at a time as I go through life. Also, where he talks about the 10th step, we have the AA code. Lots of folks don't know that there is an AA code, but it's right there on page 84, close to the bottom of the page. Love and tolerance of others is our code. And there, gentlemen, is the code of our selfish program, is love and tolerance of others. And I usually throw this in, and Lord knows I don't want to get into it, and I'm not into it, and I'm not emotionally into it, but I have just seen so much that I've said quite a bit from podiums over the last two or three years. Folks, it doesn't say love and tolerance of others is our code except where the smoking issue is concerned. and says, you folks that smoke, this tells us that we're supposed to be loving and tolerant of the position of people that don't smoke. Respect their position. Love them. Cooperate with them. And you folks that don't smoke, it's telling the same thing to y'all. We're supposed to love and tolerate those people who do. There are no exceptions to this. It doesn't say love and tolerance is our code, except when we are just absolutely right and know it. see, love and tolerance really is not an issue if I'm not real sure I'm absolutely right. I don't have tolerance. Doesn't even enter into the picture. until I am absolutely right that you're absolutely convinced you are dead wrong and I'm dead right. And I'm on the moral high ground and perfectly justified in my position. That's when I better start using tolerance, because it doesn't even apply anytime else. in continuing to take personal inventory, just flat what the 10th step says, in my life that has included two or three different forms. The first thing that it has been a safety net under my fourth step. You know, the things that I left, the dust bunnies that I left under the bed and hadn't noticed, or for whatever reason, the 10th step in continuing to take personal inventory has let me pick them up and toss them on out without having to go back and compulsively re-clean the whole house. Continuing to take personal inventory for me has been probably an average of once a year for the last 15 years of doing an inventory that looks just exactly like fourth step inventory. And that I use just exactly that guide that's on page 64 through 70. Do it exactly that same way. Because of the way Terry sponsored me, I call that 10th step work, continuing to take personal inventory. And again, I'm not trying to make a big deal out of that. I'm just offering you that has been helpful to me. That has let me live in recovery rather than continue to wallow in the illness in my mind. And that's been important to me, please. They continue to take personal inventory. I also believe for me involves my nightly checklist, and this has always confused me a tad, because this is actually in the 11th step part of the big book, but it's worked for me to use it as part of continuing to take inventory. And that's on page 86. The first full paragraph tells us just exactly to do what to do when we go to bed. It says, when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. And it's got these questions that we ask ourselves. Where was I resentful? Where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest today? Where was I afraid today? Do I owe an apology for anything that happened today? Have I kept something to myself that should have been discussed with another person at once? Was I kind and loving toward all? Or did I brush somebody off, you know, not give them enough attention because I was so busy and what they had was so insignificant, you know? What could I have done better? Questions get harder as they go along. Was I thinking of myself most of the time? By this time, I'm usually getting in trouble. Or was I thinking of what I could do for others, of what I could pack into the stream of life? And then it goes ahead and tells us what this book tells us over and over and over again, that we are not the issue. It says, but we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. And do you suppose that's going to be because that would damage our spiritual condition and make us not feel good? Uh-uh. It says that we must be careful not to do that, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. Once again, it's in every step in this book. Is that the purpose doesn't have anything to do with making us feel okay and making us okay. That's going to happen as a byproduct of trying to fit ourselves to be of maximum use to God and those around us. It will happen. And in my experience, it only happens when I'm not concentrating on fixing myself and making me okay. As long as I concentrate on trying to make me feel okay, it never happens. It isn't until I start concentrating on what I can do of you and lay it aside and say, yeah, I don't feel right. I wish it felt different, but the way I feel is no longer the center of the universe. You know, there may be a few more things in this universe that are a little more important than how little Donnie Major feels this morning. So why don't you try, Don, to give a little love, comfort, and understand to people around you, even though you don't feel very good this morning, Donnie. Maybe that'll help a little bit. And then, of course, that's when the magic happens. When I let go of concentrating on me is when I finally get filled up. on the other part of the 10th step, which says that when we were wrong, promptly admitted it, the book in talking about that is real clear. In fact, Bill in that paragraph describes it as we do it immediately, we do it quickly, at once. He just goes over and over. And Cherry told me, that it looked like to him I had a tendency to want to change that word to eventually, promptly. And he said, and that is perfectly fine, Don, said, if you want to be comfortable eventually, you just keep on admitting that you were wrong eventually. So on the other hand, if you want to be comfortable promptly, then you better do what the step says, and when you're wrong, promptly admit it, because he would repeat over and over that God will give you people, places, things, and situations. Like Dennis was talking the other night, and I agree wholeheartedly, my God wants me to have things beyond my wildest dreams, and my God will shower me with them the instant I can have them and not hurt myself with them. The instant. But God's a good parent. He's not going to give me something. He's not going to give a sharp knife to a three-year-old. You know, the instant that I'm to the point where I can have a situation or things without hurting myself with them, my God is eager to give it to me. God's never late. God's right on time. But he won't give me those things until that point. But Cherry kept telling me over and over, but God will give you comfort, Don, any time you'll take it. Said, all you've got to do is lay down that paintbrush of self-will that you have painted yourself into whatever corner you have painted yourself in. And the instant you lay it down, say, oops, I'm sorry, Dad, I did it again. I'm sorry, I'm going to try to do it. I'm going to try to do it your way and not mine. Said, you'll get your comfort. So he said, if he said, the steps are here in a way to make us comfortable, although they're directed toward God and others, a byproduct is our comfort. So he said, if you want to be comfortable promptly, do it promptly. Moving on to step 11. Step 11, I guess I would have to say that step 6 and 7 have been my pet steps for the last 7.5 years. But for the 9 years before then, I'd have to say very clearly that step 11 was my favorite step or my pet step. And step 11 is still immensely important in my life. It's described in the book, and this has been a part of my morning meditation for since the first 6 months of my sobriety, is to read page 86, 87, and the top of 88, beginning with On Awakening. That's where it begins talking about what I need to do in the mornings and what I need to do as I go through the day. And as far as I'm concerned, there's not a more beautiful, more helpful few pages in the big book than pages 86, 87, and top of 88. Now, the 11th step says that we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Early on in sobriety, after I was just becoming spiritually tuned in and, you know, again trying to impress Cherry, I said, well, Cherry, how do I begin to work on this conscious, improving my conscious contact with God in the mornings? And he said, Don, get your book out and look on page 86. He said, says there that on awakening we do certain things, including asking God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. He said, Don, if that had meant that after we go to the bathroom, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives, it would say right there on 86, it would say after we peed, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced and so on. He said, in your case, it's very, very important for a couple of reasons that you do it the way the book says, and other than the way your common sense tells you would be just fine. He said, the first reason you need to do it on awakening instead of after you go to the bathroom is the book says do it on awakening. He said, that's the biggest reason. He said, the second reason you need to do it that way is that you are perfectly capable of getting crazy enough between the bed and the bathroom to ruin the rest of your life. You know, that it really wouldn't take any longer than that for you to make and act on a decision that would ruin the rest of your life. So he said, if you want this deal to work for you, you follow the instructions. And as soon as your eyes fly open, you run that prayer through your head, God, please direct my thinking, especially let it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. and over these all these years, it's gotten pretty well automatic. There's got to be something going on pretty unusual when I wake up, when that doesn't run through my head, you know, right after I come conscious in the morning, and that has worked just beautifully for me. It tells me, we were talking about miracles this morning, we were talking about it yesterday, it tells me that all sorts of things are going to happen when I follow the instructions. It says that if I'll just be still and know that He's God, when I'm thinking about the day, I may face indecision, might not be able to determine which course to take. It says, I ask God for inspiration, for an intuitive thought or decision, then I relax and take it easy, I don't struggle. You know that deal we were talking about that counselor with that vision of her in God's hands, and God saying, now, Carlene, I can't help you with you acting like that. Now, honey, you calm down. I'm going to take care of everything, but you've got to quit acting such a fool, so I can help you. So that tells me I quit acting a fool, quit jumping around, and pray for the guidance, and then go pick up what's in front of me. You know, go wash the dishes. Go return the telephone call that doesn't have anything to do with my overwhelming problem. And I just wait and relax, and my God takes care of it for me. Tells me that this becomes a working part of the mind. It also tells me, and I've had a lot of fun over the years with what I call page 87 absurdities. It tells me that when I start doing this, that being inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it's not probable that I'm going to be inspired all the time, and that I might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Fellas, I could keep us laughing until noon today with the ideas that I have been convinced were God's will for me over the last 16 and a half years. You talk about some absurd actions and ideas. I have had them. I have had them. And I think we all do. And that's okay. That's why this is in here to let us know, hey, that doesn't mean you got to throw the baby out with the dishwater. You're not going to perfectly know, you know, you're not going to be interpreting God's will perfectly every time. You're going to do some really stupid stuff. and that's okay. God's forgiveness is always here. We can't exhaust it. It's there 24 hours a day, every hour, every minute, every step of the way. All we've got to do is just take God's forgiveness and go right and say, oop, Dad, I'm sorry. Did it again. You know, I'll keep on stumbling in the right direction. And that's all it's been for me. This is where it says that we're careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can easily see why. Remember when we talked about 6 and 7, it took me 9 years to understand that praying for a character defect to be gone because I wanted it gone is praying for my selfish ends. You know, there may be a purpose for that character defect sticking around that God's going to use somewhere in God's pattern. And for me to grab it by the collar and slam that character defect up against the wall and say, okay, God, I got him cornered. Come give me a little help. God's not coming unless God was ready for it to go anyway. So I don't need to pray. The step itself says I prayed only for knowledge of God's will for me, and the power to carry that out. Now, if God's will for me is something that I can carry out, then that's talking about actions. That's not praying that I'm going to get some sort of understanding of this big picture of God's will. That's praying that I'll be able to listen when God tells me what that next right thing is, and that I'll have the strength and power to go ahead and do that next right thing. Because God only reveals His will to me in what action I should take. God doesn't sit down and talk to me about why there are a bunch of starving children in India. He doesn't sit and talk to me about why the murder rate's up in Louisville. He doesn't sit down and talk to me about why the alcoholics out there dying this morning and we are here, you know, and why we are chosen to be here and they are not. God doesn't consult me on that. If I get to worrying about it, I'm right back in that position. I'm a chimpanzee trying to understand quantum physics. I'm never going to understand it, and I need to pull into that only part of God's will that's got any relativity to me at all. And that's what is the next right action for me to take in this instant, right now. And beyond that, I don't need to worry myself with God's will. If God ever wants to share it with me, I expect God will, but he hadn't yet. Talks about what we do in the morning. Now, the next part that we get to down here, I have never ceased, like I said, in sobriety to do my morning praying, and the vast majority of the mornings do my morning meditation, which involves my reading and then making a gratitude list and a list of things to do today. But the pit that I've fallen in over and over and over again is that even though I continue to do that 1% in the morning and that 1% at night, I'll fall into stages of ignoring the other 98% of the day. And it don't work that I get up and God fixes me for the whole day and says, yeah, okay, Don, check with me before you go to bed tonight. That doesn't work, because the book tells me that as I go through the day, I pause if I'm agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. And then whether I'm agitated or doubtful or not, I constantly remind myself every day that I am no longer running the show, humbly saying to myself many times each day, every day, regardless of what's going on, thy will be done, thy will be done. And on the good days when I'm walking to court, when I kind of tap out with my shoes on the concrete and running through my head, thy will be done, thy will be done, I'm no longer running the show, thy will be done, I'm no longer running the show, thy will be done, I'm no longer running the show, Lord, those days go well. Those days go beautifully. And on those days when I check in with God in the morning and plan to check in with him before I go to bed tonight, but I don't keep that conscious contact under that other 98%, it doesn't go too well. During those days, I can get, and I do get in, into an awful lot of messes. Now, these 11th step promises on page 88, I said earlier that I think the third step promises are the most beautiful, but they're not much more beautiful than these 11th step promises. Says that if I do what the book's just told me in this last 2.5 pages, it says that I am going to be in much less danger of excitement. Some of us had an informal conversation about that earlier in the weekend, and we didn't even know excitement was something to be avoided. We thought all of our life that excitement was something to be pursued. But I understand now that what I really want is some joy, and I want some peace. I don't want that jagged edge, you know, that jagged edge inside myself of that raw excitement. I don't want that at all. And the book puts that first. You know, I don't think any happenstances in here. I don't think that just happens to be the first thing that's mentioned. I think it's mentioned because it's the first thing to avoid. It says that I'll be in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. It says that I will become much more efficient. It says that I won't tire so easily because I won't be burning up energy foolishly as I did when I was trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. And then as Gene referred yesterday, I think, to the shortest paragraph in the big book, here's one of the most powerful promises in the deal. It works. It really does. And fellas, if you haven't been making 86, 87, and 88 a part of your daily life, please, please do yourselves a favor and try that, because if you get the results from it that I've gotten over my life, it's the best investment of time that I can think of, because it works. It really does. It changes my life. My life is a different world when I take step 11 through that whole day, when I take God in the car with me. There's still times, and I know it sounds nutty, a guy 16 years sober, there's still times when I open the door for God on the passenger side and let God get in. I take God to the bathroom with me. Talk about being constipated this morning, aren't we, partner? You know, and go right on. And that's so important, because that's my constant, my constant conscious contact with God. And when I do that, my life is a different world than when I'm out there on my own checking in with God in the morning, checking in with God at night. So give that a try. Now, in the 12 and 12, on page 99, where it talks about the 11th step is the prayer of St. Francis. So the prayer of St. Francis is very much a part of our AA literature. And it was an extremely important prayer to the early folks. And no prayer is more important to me than the prayer of St. Francis. It's a beautiful prayer that's been part of my morning meditation for my entire sobriety. And, you know, the whole essence of what we've been talking about this weekend, what that prayer says, it says, I've got to lose myself in order to find myself. You know, I've got to die in order to awaken to eternal life. It says that in my relations with human beings, Lord, let me be unconcerned with whether I am understood, loved, or comforted, and only concerned with what I can do to understand, love, and comfort those around me. And I mentioned this earlier, too, that's been so magic in my life. Whether my human encounter that was about to happen was to wake my daughter up with a kiss when we were on good terms, or whether my human encounter was to meet a man to make amends that I thought very much might want to kill me or might want to send me to the penitentiary. I have found that when I will pray my 11th step prayers, and as far as I'm concerned, my kind of mantra that I run through my head for my 11th step prayers is, thy will be done. I'm no longer running the show. And Lord, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand this person rather than to be loved, comforted, and understood by him. I have never had, and I know this is a strong statement, but I swear to you that it is the truth. I have never had a human encounter go badly when I have remembered to pray those prayers and carry those prayers and my silent prayers directly into that encounter. In front of judges, I've done it with all sorts of things. I've done it before making amends, and I've never had it fail. It's been the most powerful and effective tool in human relations that I have ever found by far. And, you know, that prayer to love, comfort, and understand rather than to be loved, comforted, and understood, that, like so many things, that's praying to change me absolutely, 180 degrees, make me the opposite of what I've always been, because very, very clearly, all of my life, I believed that you and I couldn't really begin to communicate until I got you to understand me. That was the first step, was to get you to understand me. And then, of course, I could work on getting you to love and comfort me. And this prayer tells me, no, Don, that's backwards. You're not supposed to be concerned at all with whether you are understood, loved, or comforted. You're supposed to pray to be able to understand, love, and comfort the people. And we already mentioned this in another context, but the paradox, the beautiful paradox. That's the only time that I get the love, comfort, and understanding that I feel like I need. Is when I quit demanding it, when I quit looking for it, and I simply try to give it. That's the only time I can get it. And that's another one of those beautiful paradoxes in the program. For me, my meditation, I thought meditation was going to be something impractical. I thought it was something monks did, you know, like contemplating their belly button or levitating, and I was 180 degrees wrong on that too. My meditation wound up being after I've pray and do my morning reading and have made my gratitude list. I sit there and listen to God kind of and make a list of things that if I do them that day, I'll feel more comfortable. If I don't do them, I don't think I'll feel very comfortable when the day's over. So I make that list of things too, and I don't have any lines between work things, AA things, family things, and personal things. It's just all one life and it's just all one God. That's another thing that I may not get around to. Earlier, I went through a period of years in sobriety having problems with balance in my life, fellas. You know, my life just wasn't balanced, and it seemed like that I needed to work harder in order to bring some balance into my life. And I began to working on getting my life into balance. And, of course, I did a world of praying about getting my life balanced, and I wound up going to outside counseling, page 133, trying to balance my life. And that fellow helped me try to balance my life. Kept getting worse. Couldn't understand what was going on. And finally, one day, Billy Hogan and I were talking on the phone. It hit both of us about the same time. My God, if I could balance my life, I could manage it. Of course I can't balance my life, for God's sake. My life is not only unmanageable, it's unbalanceable by definition. If it is unmanageable, it's unbalanceable by me.
Mm-hmm.
See, my life's not unmanageable. My life's not unbalanceable. But it's God who manages, and it's God who balances. It's unmanageable by me, and it's unbalanceable by me. So when I quit trying to balance my life and just said, God, whatever you put in front of me, I'm going to do. You know, and you know, if you get it wrong, get mixed up, put more on me than I can handle, then just so be it. But I can do the next right thing. You know, he hadn't got my file mixed up at the time. And my life, when I do that, God seems to be just perfect at balancing. And I quit trying to balance, and I just do that next right thing and let my God balance for me. Already talked about the fact it doesn't matter that those prayers don't feel right. And I did want to say one thing that I didn't before on that difference between the daily reprieve being contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition and it being contingent on my spiritual condition. I gave you one side of the coin, that I can wake up feeling like my spiritual condition is terrible. But if I do all those actions, even though I'm doing them grudgingly and I don't want to do them, I will get my daily reprieve. I will not drink and drug that day. On the other hand, I can wake up feeling so holy and so in tune with God that it seems like God and I are going to join hands and go out here and merge with the ether. And I can feel so close to God, it's not necessary for me to pray because my life is a prayer. God and I are in constant communication. So it's no need for me to get on my knees this morning. And I can think lovingly of you folks with your problems in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm involved in spiritual growth here, and I don't have time to take your telephone call. God will provide somebody else to help them. God and I are communing here. And then I can think lovingly about that meeting, but I have such important spiritual work to do, I can't get over there today. And I won't tell you, fellas, I'm getting drunker than Cooter Brown that day.
Mm-hmm.
Just drunker than a monkey. And I woke up feeling like my spiritual condition was divine. But my actions that day are not such that they are the process of maintaining my spiritual condition. I didn't do on that day what I have to do in order to get my daily reprieve, and I have exposed myself, and I may get drunk and die. So I need to know both sides of that coin. It's all great news, because what it means is that what gets me my daily reprieve is in my control. It's my actions. But I got to do those actions. I can't get spiritual enough that those actions become less necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the actions themselves that keep me sober, not the spiritual feeling that I get following the actions. And that's so important to get that distinction. It's the actions of maintaining the spiritual condition that keep me sober on a daily basis. Then we get to step 12 itself. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Of course, the only promise that is contained actually in the steps itself is in the 12th step, saying that having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, there's certainly the implied promise there. Denny, are my camels laying over there on... Implied promise that once I have reached step 12, if I've done these steps the way the book says, that I will have had a spiritual awakening. Now, I'm not going to go into the different things that are in the books in this book on spiritual awakening. There's an excellent appendix. It talks about spiritual experience and spiritual awakening in this book. I suggest that you read it. It makes it clear that while some few people may have that dramatic burning bush type of experience like Bill Wilson had in the asylum, that the majority of us are going to have a spiritual awakening of the educational variety.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to grow in us slowly, and that those around us will probably notice the change in us before we ourselves are aware of it. That our spiritual awakening may be, but we should not expect it to be, that blinding flash of light when all at once the truth is there to us. That for most of us, and certainly my spiritual awakening has been very much of a gradual educational variety. I've never had a moment when the scales fell from my eyes and the trumpets blared and God made the truth all clear to me in one great big lump. It's all been a matter of slow growth. And also spiritual awakening means to me, it means simply that up to that point in my life, I had been spiritually comatose. I had been completely unresponsive to spirituality. I was not awake to it. I was in a coma as far as spirituality went. Having had a spiritual awakening doesn't mean that I've become a spiritual giant. It means that I woke up. It means that I woke up and I am now aware of spirituality. And I am aware of the spiritual world. And that's a great, huge difference. That's a great, huge difference for me, having been in a coma to spirituality and being awake and aware of it as I go on. Step says that we tried to carry the message to alcoholics. Thank goodness that word is carry rather than deliver. Because if it was deliver, the 12th step would be giving us an impossible order, and we'd drive ourselves crazy trying to deliver the message to people. But we just carry this message with us. You know the old deal that we may be the only big book somebody ever sees? I believe that with all my heart. And I've had dozens of instances where people have come to me and I had no idea they were watching me. No idea they were watching me. And they were watching me. And I was a big book for them to see. And it's a good idea. Not that I can do this perfectly, believe me. I still pick my nose driving down the road and I get aggravated and everything. But I need to remember that whatever I'm doing, whatever I'm saying is a reflection of my higher power. And if I'm giving the guy the finger in the traffic, then if somebody that might later be helped with me or knows me sees that, then I've just given them a picture of my relationship with my God. And I've let them know what I am. And that's probably not going to be helpful. So I need to bear in mind, I need to carry the vision of God's will into all of my daily activities, just like the book says. There's some little things that over the years have been helpful to me, and they sound high-minded, and I haven't been able to attain anything nearly perfect adherence to them, but they've been helpful. If whatever I'm getting ready to do or say would be a real mess, if it was all on the front page of the Courier Journal tomorrow, I better not do it or say it. You know, certainly there are a lot of things I do and say that we'd rather not have on the front page paper, that they'd be embarrassing and that sort of thing. But if it'd be a real mess, you know, if it'd just be terrible, if it was on the front page of the Courier Journal tomorrow, I better not do it. I better not say it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real good little thing to keep in my mind, that if this were going to be on the front page of the paper tomorrow, would it be a good idea for me to say or do what I'm getting ready to say or do? Helps me a whole bunch. Carrying the message, you know, Cherry talked to me an awful lot about big deals and the fact that any time I make a big deal out of anything, that isn't God in these 12 steps, that what I'm really making a big deal out of is me. And when I do that, I'm back into ego and I'm back into alcoholism. You know, in my life, it seems very clear to me that carries right on through to sponsorship. You know, if I make such a big deal out of me sponsoring somebody and what I say to them, and I'm just terrified, my God, I'm afraid I'll say something to somebody that'll kill them. You think a fella could run around the country doing this? If he thought he was so important that some word that he said was apt to kill somebody, or some word that he said was apt to just save somebody's soul, it'd be impossible. My Lord, it'd break your back to do this job if a fella, you know, felt like he was that important and it was such a big deal. Now, among the guys that I've sponsored and over the years, I'm sure it's over 100 that I've sponsored at some time or another over the years. I have got guys that are out giving talks to huge crowds at special events, and they're sponsoring 20 people themselves, and people are kind of throwing gardenias at them about what great programs they've got. I have got other guys that I've sponsored that are laying in graveyards this morning from alcoholism and drug addiction. I've got other guys I've sponsored who are in penitentiaries for things they did after I was their sponsor. I've got them out there on the street just dying. And as best I can tell, I told all of those guys, and more importantly, showed all of those guys the same thing. Now, I'm no longer a sociopath, and I'm really not. So I've got a lot of sadness about the guys that are dead and in the penitentiary and out there dying. I've got a lot of sadness about them. And I've got some joy for the guys that are doing so well this morning.
Mm-hmm.
But I won't tell you that I don't feel a bit of credit for the ones that are doing so well, and I don't feel a bit of guilt for the ones that are dead and in the penitentiaries. I feel sorry for them, but I ain't that big, guys. I'm not that big. All I can do is carry this message, and I'm not responsible for your reaction to that message. In fact, my whole life, one of the things that helps me in my daily life more than anything is to picture myself going through my day as a 1930s Western Union telegram boy.
Huh.
And I've had that picture for 15 years, and it's so helpful. Did you ever think how impossible that little Western Union telegram boy's job would be if he were responsible for the contents of the messages that he was delivered, and he was further responsible for the reaction of the people to whom the message was delivered? My God, that little fellow would be pedaling along on his bicycle with his little cafe. Oh, my God, these people's son's dead. Oh, this is awful. How are they going to react to this? Oh, my God, my God. They've gone broke and they don't know it. And it's right here. Oh, what are they going to do when they find that out? No way in the world you could do that job. God, it'd break your back. But the Western Union messenger boy's job doesn't have anything to do with the content of the message or the reaction of the receiver of the message. The Western Union messenger boy's job is to quietly and lovingly deliver the message. Well, I got news for you guys. If I live to December, I'll be 54 years old, and best of my knowledge, I have never once created the truth. I don't create the truth. The truth just is. And my job is the quiet and loving delivery of the truth. What you do with the truth after I have quietly and lovingly delivered the truth as best I can discern it, that's up to you, and that's beyond my power. And the Western Union messenger boy can do his job when he does that, and I'm do my job on the days when I'm just peddling around, and I'm not responsible for the content, and I'm not responsible for your reaction. I'm very responsible for the quiet and honest and loving delivery of it, but not beyond that. And that makes my life so much easier. Practicing these principles in all my affairs is very much an action thing. Very much an action thing. You know, if the problem in my life today is that my bed is not made up, and that's aggravating me, and I've got that on my mind that bed's not made up, and I just can't figure it out, man, I can't get the motivation to make that bed, and it's just really aggravating me. And I'd call up Tom Burns in Cleveland and aggravate Tom a while about, Tom, I don't know what's wrong, but I just can't get the motivation to make this bed, and it's worrying me to death. And I can pray about that bed, and, you know, Lord, please take away this procrastination on making this bed. And I can go to discussion meetings and dominate the discussion meetings about how it's worrying me that bed's not made up. And I'd finally go on to counseling and pay them $100 an hour and talk to them about the fact that bed is made up, not made up. and I will get absolutely no relief until I make the damn bed. None at all. God's not apt to, God makes very few beds for me. You know, and I can go do, jump through all these hoops, do all these things, and I won't get any relief until I make the bed. So practicing in my affairs has an awful lot to do with action. You know, forgiving, I found that what I need to do is act out forgiveness to people. Pages 551 through 553 in the big book, one of the stories give me a real good prayer that I say and says that if I do that for a couple of weeks, that I'll start feeling some forgiveness. But the important thing, I had to go to the bedside probably 6 years ago to a family member that it was a deathbed. Everybody thought it turned out not to be at that time, but the doctors and everybody thought it. And that family member had been involved in the long-term sexual molestation of my daughter. And I didn't find that out until after I was sober and after it was over with. And when I got the call to go to that deathbed, I not only didn't want to go, I didn't think I ought to go. Thought what had been done there was beyond forgiveness, that it was beyond what I even ought to try to forgive. But I wasn't altogether comfortable with that, so I got to praying and I got to talking to you guys, and the answer got real clear to me. When I wind up running my mouth, we're going to hold hands, just like I do 4 or 5 times a week with people. And I'm going to ask my God to forgive me by just precisely the same standard that I forgive my fellow man. Just precisely the same standard. Now, I want to tell you something. I don't know about you guys, but I am way too far gone to be putting any limits on my God's forgiveness of me by limiting my willingness to forgive other human beings. And it also got very clear to me that if I draw a line and say, up to this line, I'm going to be the kindest, most forgiving thing on earth, and the line's generous, but if you step over that line, damn you, I'll not even try to forgive you. I'm not partially forgiving, I'm totally unforgiving. I'm just forgiving when I want to and drawing the line saying I don't want to beyond this line, and I won't forgive you if you do that. I'll forgive A, B, and C, but if you do D, shame on you. So I went down first thing I did, I told my friends, I said, my God, I can't forgive that. And they said, Don, you just mean you can't feel like you forgive it. Said, you go down to that bedside and you act like a fellow would act. If a fellow had forgiven, it'd work just fine. And I went down to that bedside and I began acting out forgiveness, and I want to tell you it worked just fine. Now, it was awful uncomfortable at first because that was the cardinal sin. You know, we alcoholics are peculiar. We chuckle all time. We have done it this weekend about larceny. You know, that's a source of great hilarity. Fornication and adultery and that sort of things are fodder for great laughter. Even the occasional well-placed homicide can get a small chuckle, you know, if it's told in the right context. But my God, we don't want to be hypocrites. Oh, Lord, we don't want to be hypocrites. You know, that's the worst thing on earth. So I thought when I was going down there to that bedside and acting that out that forgiveness, I didn't feel in my heart that I was being hypocritical. Then I got to thinking about it. You know that prayer that I pray, we all pray that Lord's Prayer? When I ask God to forgive me just exactly like I forgive other people, it don't make any difference to me whether God feels like forgiving me or not. Doesn't make a bit of difference in my life whether God wants to forgive me or feels like God has forgiven me. The only thing that's important is that God acts like God has forgiven me. So if I give that to my fellow man and I get just exactly what I pray for, that God gives me exactly the same measure that I measure out on forgiveness, I'll be just fine. Thank you. So once that got clear to me, so forgiveness is not a feeling, it's actions. Gratitude's not a feeling for me anymore. Gratitude's action. If I waited until I felt grateful for AA to do things for AA, I wouldn't do 90% of the stuff I do. I do gratitude, and that's the real gratitude. You know, those things that I know I ought to feel grateful for. When I act out gratitude by doing things to support them and doing good things for them. I don't feel grateful for my wife every minute, but I try to act grateful for my wife most of the time. And then what happens is that after I've acted out the gratitude, somewhere along the line I get that nice warm feeling of feeling so grateful that I thought was gratitude. That ain't gratitude. That's the reward for gratitude. Gratitude is sometimes quite uncomfortable when I'm not feeling like doing it at all. But I'm out there doing those actions. And then that nice warm feeling that I thought was gratitude comes around as a reward for it. Same thing's true of faith. Faith is not comfortable. Faith's scary. Lord, it's awful. Because faith isn't that nice warm fuzzy feeling of God having me in the palm of the hand and everything being okay. Faith is doing that next right thing when my brain is yelling, this is stupid. This is really stupid, butthole. You know, you're really going to get it for doing this sanctimonious crap. That's faith, is going ahead and doing that when I'm so scared and my knees are shaking, my palms are sweating, and my brain's telling me it won't work, but my heart tells me it's right. After it all works out fine and I get that nice warm feeling of, oh, I knew it'd work out all along, you know, and God got me in the palm of the hand, that ain't faith. That's the reward for faith. Faith was doing that next right thing when I was scared to death to be doing it. when I go down to my law office and I try to win cases and make money and impress people, it winds up being the damnedest mess you've ever seen in your life. But when I let go of all that and I go down to that office and I just try to love, comfort, and understand people, and I just try to help God's kids do what they need to have done for free and for fun because I want to, and do that next right thing, God's a whole lot better lawyer than I am, fellas. World better lawyer. My life goes better. It seemed to me when I got sober, there wasn't any way in the world spiritual principles could apply to the practice of criminal defense law, which is what I had done exclusively all my life up to then, and since then I've done personal injury in that. But what I found out was that those things that my brain told me wouldn't work, like the quiet and loving truth, most effective tools on earth. I can honestly say, and this is not bragging, I'm just giving you a fact out of my life, I was a really quite effective, very fiery trial lawyer before I got sober. Over the last 10 years, I have been, record-wise, a more effective trial lawyer than I ever was. There's a difference, though. In over 10 years, I haven't raised my voice in or out of a courtroom. I have felt like raising my voice probably 50,000 times in the last 10 years, and I have wanted to raise my voice, and I have felt like that it would be very educational for that butthole for me to raise my voice. But I haven't raised my voice in over 10 years in or out of a courtroom, and it's worked just fine. You know, I don't need to be examining whether these principles work. I need to just do them. I need to just do them. And whatever it is in my life, I don't need to ask myself, what am I getting out of this? I don't care whether it's this weekend. I don't care whether it's my wife. I don't care whether it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't care whether it's my work. I don't care whether it's my child. Because if I ask myself, what am I getting out of this, and continue to ask that question for 30 seconds, the answer has always been not enough. I don't care what I'm asking it about. So after 54 years nearly, the only conclusion I can come to is the question of what am I getting out of this is quite simply the wrong question. The right question is, what can I bring to this? What can I give to this? And, Lord, I wind up loving those things that I make myself give to and that I make myself bring to. But when I start, instead of giving and bringing, when I start taking my spiritual and emotional temperature and saying, wait a minute, what are you getting out of this, Don? You know, answer's never 30 seconds. Answer's not enough. So I just don't need to ask that question. You know, no big deals thing, that's what, big deals are what cause stress in my life. finally got clear 3 or 4 years ago. If I'm not making a big deal out of something that's not God or these 12 steps, stress is impossible. And that's changed my life. Because up to that point, stress just went with the territory of my high-profile, high-powered life, don't you know? It was just part of the, but part of the territory. And now when I feel stress, it's not a necessary part of it. It's a spiritual mistake. And I know what it is. I'm making a big deal out of something that's not God and not these 12 steps, and therefore a big deal out of me. And if I'll talk to you guys about it, I guarantee you my big deal is never a big deal to you. Not one time. And yours is never a big deal to me. And we can tell one another just exactly how a person would act to whom it's not a big deal. And when I'll go ahead and follow what you tell me and start acting like a fellow would act that didn't feel like it was a big deal kind of goes away. I spent a lot of time trying to have faith that my health would work out and my family would work out and all that sort of thing. Finally found out that I was completely misunderstanding faith. If I'm going to try to have faith that I'll be healthy and faith that my daughter will live, that's not faith, that's hope. I don't have faith until I've reached a point, and this sounds unspiritual, but I guarantee you it's been one of the most helpful spiritual principles in my life. Until I can think it through, that if something happened that my daughter died, if I came up with a terminal disease, if I lost my law license, if this happened and that happened, if I get to the point where, yeah, well, God, I sure wouldn't like those things, and there's some things there that I really prefer not to happen, but I know you'll take care of me and of everybody involved, even in those circumstances, then I'm dealing with faith. As long as I'm dealing with that hope that in order for me to be okay, I got to hold on to that job, or I got to hold on to that kid, or I got to hold on to this health, I'm dealing with self-will. It isn't until I'm willing to let God make me okay, regardless of what God does with the surroundings in my life, that I begin to get begin to deal with faith itself. I can't figure out who I need to help. I need to help just whoever put God in front of me. My decision-making process is not nearly as powerful as I thought it was. First couple of years I was sober, I would sit around and agonize about the decisions. And I thought God had the world set up like a game show, where if I guessed the right square, I got trips to Acapulco, and if I guessed the wrong square, I got dragons and stuff. God hadn't got set up that way. If I've got a good faith decision, now the decision of whether to rob a liquor store or go to a meeting is probably not a good faith decision. But if I've got a good faith decision, I've prayed about it, and I've drawn that line down the center of the piece of paper, that Benjamin clothes, or Franklin clothes that Ed was talking about, and written on one side why I should do this and the other side why I should do that, and I've consulted with folks on it, and it's still not clear which way I could go, should go. Either way that I go, if I do God's will a step at a time, it's going to work out just fine. Either way that I go, if I don't do God's will a step at a time, it's going to be a bucket of crap. So what difference does it make which way I go? See, I had my little decision-making process just blown all out of proportion. Like, oh, this is so important. If I choose this, hey, if it's a good faith decision, either way I go, if I do God's will a step at a time, it'll be just fine. And that took a lot of pressure off. Sponsorship, real important, of course. My view of a sponsor is a guide through the steps. I've already mentioned that I have Bernie, who's a sponsor of mine and a dear friend, and Tom has become a friend. Cherry Carpenter and I were never friends. And I told you, and it's tongue-in-cheek, but it's a lot of truth in it, too. I never really liked Cherry. I loved him, but as far as liking him, I didn't like his personality. And I don't think Cherry liked me a whole lot. But that didn't diminish the sponsorship relationship, because he was always there with help through these steps. And that's what it is now. The other part of it, the fellowship, the warm, loving thing I have with Bernie, with Tom, with some of you guys, and with my friends in the program, that's extremely necessary. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not saying that that isn't of great value and that we don't everyone need it desperately. I'm just saying that your guide through the steps doesn't necessarily have to be the same person that's providing you with that sort of thing. Guys, thank you. Thank you so much for putting up with me this weekend, having me here, and I actually got wound up a little more on living sober this morning than I meant to, but I guess it was the way that it meant to be. So God bless you, and thank you for letting me be with you this weekend.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you, fellas.